If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
I'm Tony Dean, and today we'll be calling history to speak with Sacagawea. She'll be answering our call on October 30th, 1810, at the age of 24, just a few years after the completion of the Lewis and Clark expedition. So little is known about Sacagawea, and almost nothing was written. In fact, even her death was disputed. She either died 2 years after this conversation in 1812 of sickness, or she lived another 72 years to be an old woman after leaving her repressive husband that most likely won her in a poker game. And then she may have married someone in the Comanche tribe. Lewis and Clark described her as courageous, determined, and indispensable, but wrote little about her emotional state. In the next two episodes, you're going to learn about the tragic circumstances that caused her to guard her feelings and opinions for her entire life. Yet it is no wonder that she is revered and seen as a hero after being kidnapped at the age of 12 and then basically thrown into a canoe to travel across the United States with an infant in her arms. An infant that in the end very likely saved every person's life on that trip. She overcame incredible odds and found a way to survive regardless of what challenges life threw at her. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow history lovers, and pickers of berries everywhere, I give you Sacagawea. Hello, is that you, Sacagawea?
Yes, I am Sacagawea.
I am so excited to speak with you. My name is Tony Dean, and I'm talking to you from the future in the 21st century. The device that you're holding in your hand is called a smartphone, and it allows us to speak as if you and I were 5 feet from one another. It also allows me to share a record of our conversation with people around the world. I was hoping I could ask you some questions today, but before I do, I understand this is a very strange introduction. Can I answer any questions that you might have first?
Well, the first question that I wanted to ask you is, are you sure you want to talk with me? Men rarely talk with me, and no one has ever asked me my story or about my thoughts, feelings, my needs, my wants. And so this is very strange.
Well, I'll tell you that it's as strange for you to make a statement like that to me, because in our time, women see you as a hero. Women look up to you. Your face is on money in our time because of the journey that you took with Lewis and Clark and the stories that we hear about how you aided in that westward expansion and the courage and the fact that you did it with a child and all of that. People in our time look up to you like you can't imagine. So I'm surprised to hear you say that. But I guess the first question that I'd like to ask you, because we're very interested in your story, is even though people see you in that light in this time, your life didn't exactly start that way. At a very young age, you were kidnapped. Is that not right?
Yes, that is very true. I think I was like 10 or 12 winters when I was kidnapped and taken away from my family. So that was, just thinking about that now makes me so sad, because I was away from my family and I only ever got to see someone in my family once for the rest of my life. So that was terrible. Do you want me to tell you how I was kidnapped? What happened?
Yes, please. I'd love to hear that story.
Well, I was with my friends. It was springtime and we were gathering berries. That was one of the things that we did because we lived in the Bitterroot Mountains and the mountains are very rocky. So we did not grow plants. We would always just find roots or berries, things that were growing in the ground, and we would dig them up. And so since it was springtime, it was a wonderful time to get berries. I think we ate more berries than we put in the basket. And so we were just there gathering berries, and all of a sudden we heard horses coming. There were lots of horses. And when we looked, we saw that it wasn't our people. It was another nation called the Hadatsas. They were our enemies. And they had guns. We did not have guns. Our men only had bows and arrows. So they came on these horses, and it was so frightening. And for a moment, I, I just froze because I didn't know what to do. And a friend of mine, Jumping Fish, she said, run. And so I started to run behind her. And there were gunshots. I heard bows and arrows going off and the horses. There were so many people. I don't even know how many Hadatsas there were coming after us. And so I was running as fast as I could. And I couldn't keep up with Jumping Fish because she was taller than me. Her legs were longer than mine. And all of a sudden, some warrior on a horse grabbed me and pulled me up on his horse, and I saw Jumping Fish in the distance, and I so wished that I was with her, but I knew that I was captured. I knew that they were going to take me away, and I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. He just grabbed me, and I stopped struggling, and there were just too many Hadatsas, and I was afraid. What would happen to me? I knew they were going to take me away from my family and my home, and I was so afraid. And I didn't know what they were saying because they were speaking a language that I did not understand. I was so scared. Eventually, I realized that some of our men were killed. I think there were maybe 4 of our men and some of our women who were shot with these weapons that they call a gun. It was just so horrible. And I was so afraid.
Sounds terrible. So did your tribe not have guns?
No, we only had bows and arrows. And that's one of the reasons we lived in the mountains, because some of the other tribes had traded with people that they called the white men. And they had these weapons called guns, but we did not. And so we lived way up in the Bitterroot Mountains because that way we'd be safe. We did not have guns. They made me walk hundreds of miles from my home to their village near the Knife River. And that's when I understood that I was now enslaved to the Hadatsas and that I didn't think I would ever see my mother again. It was a very strange world because the Hadatsas were so different from the Shoshone. They were so different. Even just like the houses that they lived in were different from our houses, the way that they ate their food, it was so different. And I was so lonely. I did not speak their language. I had to learn how to speak the Hadatsa language. And I had to learn how to work and live in the houses. My people, the Shoshone, we lived in teepees. And I don't know if you're familiar with a teepee or not, but the Hadatsas, they lived in these things they called earth lodges, which had an outer circle of cottonwood posts and beams and logs, and they put willow branches and dried prairie grass and thick sod, forming a huge mound, and it had logs, vertical logs, making a doorway. And they had a huge stockade surrounding the village. And outside of that, there were fields with plants growing. They did not forage like we did. They grew food to eat, since they were not on rocky soil of the Bitterroot Mountains like us. They grew all kinds of things like corn, beans, squash. It was so different from the Shoshone. And they lived in their village, whereas the Shoshone, we were nomads. We would stay in an area, that's why we lived in teepees, and then we would follow the animals for food or move because of the winter. And so we would pack up the whole village. We could pack up a village of teepees in 1 hour and then put everything on travois, which were long sticks with horses and dogs, and move to another location. But the Hadatsas, that was their home with the stockade surrounding their village. And so I had to learn a whole new life. They did not forage. I had to learn how to plant and harvest. And I also had to learn the women would sing and pray to the corn spirits. And there were all these new rules, like you could never argue near the fields because I was told that would scare the corn spirits and destroy the crops. I had to learn how to store and cook these new foods. There was so much that I had to do. And I was just a little girl. I was a child.
I don't even know how you survive something like this. First of all, I guess I want to ask, is this common that one tribe would just steal another tribe's children or women or men for that matter and enslave them?
I think that has happened before, yes. Because eventually when I was with the Hadatsas, I met other Shoshone women who were taken from different villages. So that happened.
But it doesn't sound like the Shoshones were aggressive in that way. The Shoshones, were they more peaceful than the Hidatsus?
I would say yes, because we did not have guns. And when I was growing up, we just wanted to live our lives. We just wanted to hunt the bison, get food, get crops, move our village when it was time because of the animals moved, we would follow the animals. I would say that we were a peaceful people. The men would hunt and the women would forage, and we just wanted to live our lives. And we used our bows and arrows to hunt, except when we were attacked by another nation. That's why we lived way up in the mountains. I had never seen a white man until I went to the Hidatsa village. I had never seen so many people. It was just our village.
In your village, was that something that people talked about? Were there stories of the white men coming, or was there legend of that? Or,
well, we knew that there were people who were different from us. And we knew this because where did these Hidatsas get these guns from? It's just something that I heard, that there were these other people called white men. I had never seen one.
What would the people in your tribe, what would they be thinking about the guns? Because you've mentioned these guns a lot.
To stay away from them, and we were scared of them because we knew that if someone had them, it was going to bring death.
I see. To go to the Hidatsu village, you had to travel a lot. Tell me what that looked like.
I had to walk. The warrior who captured me, I was on his horse for a little while. Eventually, when they either had shot people in my nation or people ran away, then we were making our way back to their village. I don't know how long it took us to get there, but it was very far from where we lived to their village by the Knife River. It was so far. It took days and days. I don't even know how many days it was. I think I was probably in shock, and I was so scared. I think I just went blank in my mind. And that's something that I did for the rest of my life, pretty much. When I was a child in my village with my family and my brothers and my sisters and my friends, that was a wonderful childhood. But then once I was captured, it was like people didn't ask me how I felt about something or what I thought or what I wanted. I had to keep quiet, because I was now an enslaved person. So I learned very quickly not to show any emotion, do not show joy or sorrow or fear, because it was not safe to show emotion. If my feelings were something that the person who captured me did not like, I could be punished, I could be hit, they could deprive me of food or shelter, who knows what they would do. So I learned very quickly not to show any emotion and keep everything in my head.
When somebody gets kidnapped like this, it seems like that it would be human nature for there to be consequences, that perhaps the Shoshones of your tribe, after the Hidatsus came in and murdered people and then took children, it seems that there would be consequences, that they would get a party together and maybe go out and try to recover you. Would that be something that a person would expect? Were you thinking that you might be saved?
I did not think I would be saved, because my nation, they did not have those guns. Those guns were very powerful. How can you fight to regain your family with a bow and arrow when someone just points this weapon at you and shoots you, and it just brings death and destruction?
Boy, the guns. Once somebody has the guns, everything's different, isn't it?
Yes, it is very different. So once I was captured, I never thought that my family would come and get me. I don't even know if they knew how to get to the Hidatsa village, because we stayed in the mountains. And the Hidatsas, when I walked all those miles, we were down in, I guess it was flat land. We weren't in the mountains. When I finally got to their village, it wasn't anything like the mountains. Because remember, I said that they grew plants. They had fields, which we did not have. I don't know if my family would even know how to find them.
Yeah, it's like they're just completely across the world.
Yes.
What are the mountains to your people?
Home. It's home.
Throughout all the generations, have your people lived in the mountains?
Well, my grandfather told me that when he was young, that we didn't always live in the mountains. But when there were nations that were aggressive, eventually that's where we went to be safe.
I see. So the mountains are home and the mountains are safety.
Yes.
So as a slave, as an enslaved person, what does that mean? When you arrive at the Hidatsu village and you are now enslaved, are you somebody's property? Are you the tribe's property? Do you have to do the worst jobs? What does that look like?
Well, they gave me to a woman because they're not going to make me do the work that a man would do. And so they gave me a place to stay. They gave me food. And it was so hard because I did not speak the language. And I would not show any emotion because these people did not love me like my family did. And I didn't know, would they care for me? So I was quiet. And I tried to learn the Hadatsa language as fast as I could. And eventually I did learn the language. And I learned a lot of things. I learned how to make things from wood because they worked in the fields. I learned how to make rakes and bowls. I made corn. I had to grind corn that they would grow. I learned how to plant. I learned how to, when the plants would grow, I learned how to harvest them. I learned how to make the Hidatsas had something called bowl boats for traveling in the rivers, where they had a wooden frame and they had hide that was stretched over the frame to make the boat watertight. I learned how to make things from bison. I learned how to get sinew for thread. I learned how to make pouches from the stomach. I tanned hides to make clothes, blankets. I learned how to make brushes and tools and sleds and hoes from the bones and cups and ladles. I made moccasins and pots and pans and so much more. But I was not allowed to make baskets or pottery, because in that nation, only certain people in their nation had the right to practice those crafts. But I worked hard always. And I missed my family and my friends, and I kept thinking about how jumping fish escaped being captured, and I wish that I too had escaped. Time meant nothing to me but work and loneliness.
Jumping fish escaped, so she ran and got away? Is that what happened?
Yes. I think she always, she was so funny. She would always be running and jumping. That's how she got the name Jumping Fish, because that's just how she was. And she was taller than I was, so I could jump, but she could always jump higher than I could. She was my friend, and I missed her.
When you look back at that situation and you saw her escape, was there something that you wished you would have done different to escape?
Run faster. I wish I could have run faster. When the Hidatsa came and the warrior was there, I think at one moment I froze. I wish I didn't freeze. Maybe if I didn't freeze, I could have gotten away. I don't know.
You had mentioned, you mentioned several times white men.
Yes.
What is your impression of white men, and has that changed throughout the years?
I really didn't have much to do with them. It's not that we became friends or anything like that. It wasn't like that. I was forced to marry a white man, and I would say he was the white man that I had the most to do with. I don't know if the Hidatsas sold me to him or if he won me in a gambling game, but just one day they told me I had to go with him. And then he said that I was his wife. I had no choice.
That's how it happened? Just one day he just says, hey, you're coming with me, you're my wife? And well, that, you don't know anything other than that?
No. And I don't know how it came to be. Did he pick me, or I don't know. It's just one day they said that you go with him now. And so that's what I did.
So the man I think that you're talking about, if I'm saying his name right, it's Toussaint Charbonneau, is that right?
Yes, Toussaint Charbonneau. He spoke French and Hidatsa. I did not speak French. I learned some having lived with him, but yes.
Tell me about him. What kind of person was he?
Oh, he was a man of short temper and not always nice. He was at least 20 winters older than me, and living with him, I definitely did not show any emotion, because if he did not like something that I said or did, he was known often to yell at me, and he would often sometimes strike me. So I kept my thoughts to myself, and I tried not to speak much, except to Otter Woman, because I was not his only wife. He had another wife, Otter Woman, and she was Shoshone. She was a little bit older than me, but it was so wonderful to be able to speak my language again, because Charbonneau spoke a language called French. He also spoke some Hadatsa, but he did not speak Shoshone. Now, I spoke Hadatsa, and I spoke Shoshone. An Otter Woman spoke Hadatsa and Shoshone. So it was so nice because I could speak to her in our language and he could not understand us. She was the only one that I sometimes would share my thoughts and feelings with.
When you went on the excursion with Lewis and Clark, you were the only woman that you were around during those several years. Is that correct?
That is right. I was the only woman.
So from time to time throughout your life, it sounds like there have been several times where you were just yanked out of these environments where you had women that would support you and love you, and then you're just surrounded by men.
That is true.
That doesn't sound very safe.
Well, it was hard. It was hard. But I must confess that there was one time when I was on the, as you called it, excursion, where I don't remember what I said, but Charbonneau just turned around and he just hit me and he was yelling at me. And Monsieur Clark, he told him to stop. And he told him not to treat his woman like that.
What happened?
Well, Charbonneau stopped. Not that he changed his personality or anything like that, but he knew not to be mean to me or strike me when he was around Monsieur Clark.
So did you develop an affection for Mr. Clark because of this?
I would not say that I formed an affection to him. It was nice that he said that, but I tried to just keep to myself and be as helpful as I could, because if I was helpful, then I would not be hurt.
It's interesting that you're saying all this. I never would have put these pieces together until you said it, but Lewis and Clark kept journals. I know you know well about those. Maybe you even participated in writing some of that information. I don't know. But they kept several journals, wrote down everything that was going on. But the one thing that they did not document very well is what your attitude was about things, how you felt about everything that was going on, even how you reacted. And the fact that you, from a young age, basically had to learn to keep your emotions inside, that makes sense, because there would have been nothing for them to write because you were intentionally not putting yourself in a situation where somebody would be judging you based on your reaction because you weren't having one.
I was not important to any of those men. And I think the only reason that they wanted me to come with them is they were going across the Rocky Mountains and they were going to Shoshone land and they needed someone who spoke Shoshone to ask for horses because the mountains were very hard. And the only way that they could get across the mountains and not have to take forever was if they had horses. And so that's what they wanted me for, is they wanted me to talk to the Shoshone in the Shoshone language and ask for horses and supplies and guides because no one else spoke that language. So that's why they wanted me.
When you go back and read some of these journals, I would say that the two leaders of the expedition, Lewis and Clark, it doesn't appear that they felt that way at all, that they thought that you were quite able. In fact, there were times when I read something where there were several times that they were unable to find food, and here you are going out digging up roots and finding things that they need. Was that not happening on a regular basis?
I don't think that they knew when they took me that I had that skill. All they were thinking about was negotiating with the Shoshone, but they didn't really think about that the Shoshone, we lived in the mountains, and we were not farmers. so I could always find vegetables and roots and dig them up. And I knew what was poisonous and what was not poisonous that you could eat. And I knew of things that maybe they had never even heard of. And I think later on, they realized that was important and I was valuable for that, because they just wanted to eat meat all the time. But you can't just eat meat all the time. You could get sick. I had heard that there was this word, and I'm not sure what it means. It's scurvy. That's what they said. If they did not have some of the plants, they would get scurvy. I don't know what that is, but I know it's not good. And it comes from just eating meat all the time. So as we traveled, I just remembered what I had learned with my people. And I knew how to find that. And I knew how to dig that up. I was always doing that.
I think I see what you're saying now. So you were saying initially they didn't realize how much value you were going to add to the expedition. Later on, they realized it. But initially, you're just a person who can speak Shoshone and can get them the horses so they can get through the next phase of their journey.
Yes.
I see. That makes sense. Because, yeah, believe me, and I'm sure you probably know this now, they definitely found incredible value in everything that you did. But let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to your childhood, because long before you were on that incredible expedition going west, and long before you were kidnapped, you grew up as a Shoshone, as you've said several times, in the mountains.
Yes.
And this sounds like a wonderful place. Like, I'm listening to you talk about the mountains and the people, and they're not terribly aggressive, and it sounds wonderful. You said you had a good childhood. Tell me about that, if you would.
Well, it's not that it was easy, because we had a lot to do. It was hard, but it was still good because we moved a lot. We were nomads and there was work to be done. There was always work to be done. And living in the mountains, the winter time, it's very cold, but there were wonderful things that I remember. I remember my father hunting some bison. Have you ever eaten bison tongue or bison hump? Oh, it's very good. And so when the men would have that, my father would make sure that I would get some because it was very tasty. It was good. And like I said, picking the berries in the springtime, oh my gosh, the berries were so delicious. And then my mother showing me how to take camas roots, and you could eat it raw, but you could also cook it and make it into a soup or bread. And I remember my mother teaching me how to butcher and prepare meat. And she taught me. I remember her teaching me how to make clothing and moccasins and how to put up and take down a teepee. It was a lot of work, but work is always easier when you have a family and people care about you and love you. And even the winters when there was a lot of snow and it was hard, we would always be inside telling stories or singing and dancing. It was hard, but when you have a family, that always makes it easier.
The way that our life is right now, our culture, people really try to get away a lot of times from hard work. And I think the hard work ends up being good memories a lot of times, because you're accomplishing things, even if it is something simple as preparing food so that you have food for the winter or something else. Hard doesn't make it bad. A lot of times I think hard makes it good. But your memories of childhood, they're generally good, right?
Yes, they are good. My family was good to me. I had friends. The day that I was captured, we were just picking berries and we were having fun. And we ate more berries than we gathered. Someone said, you better make sure you fill that basket or your mother won't be happy. I guess I think about that more, because once I was captured, I don't have those kinds of memories. I don't have those kinds of memories of good times with people who love me.
Did your relationship with the Hidatsus change the longer that you lived with them? Did you integrate with their society and become one of the people there? Or were you always a slave until you were either sold or lost in a gambling debt, as you said?
I did talk to some people, some of the women, but I was always afraid. And I knew that anything could happen to me, which it did when they gave me to Charbonneau. I had no say. So I just did whatever I was told, and I kept my thoughts to myself. But I just never thought that there was someone like my mother.
I want to go back to Charbonneau for a minute. Does he go by Charbonneau, or does he go by Toussaint, or?
I call him Charbonneau.
Are you married to Charbonneau right now?
Yes.
And where are you living now?
St. Louis, a place called St. Louis.
Oh, are you in a house?
It is a house. We lived in the Mandan Hidatsa village, the five villages. But when we went on the expedition, Monsieur Clark really liked my son. Because I had a baby. Did I tell you that?
No, but believe me, I was going to ask you.
Well,
keep going.
Monsieur Clark really liked my son. He called him my dancing boy. He really liked him a lot. And I must say he did look out for me as much as he was able. And since I had the baby, he would like to hold the baby babies can be so wonderful. And so when we finished and he was going back home at the end of this whole adventure, he told Charbonneau that he would give him land and animals, and if we came to St. Louis, he would educate my son. And so Charbonneau said he'd think about it, and maybe when my son was weaned, we would go. And so eventually, my son is 4 winters now, so we went to St. Louis. And that's where Charbonneau is right now. He's meeting with Monsieur Clark about farmland and animals. He was a trapper and fur trader, and so he said we were going to go and that Monsieur Clark would give us land and animals and then we would be farmers. And so that's why we are here.
Well, how do you feel about that, about Clark taking the responsibility of educating him?
It's hard because, well, right now we're here in St. Louis. And so my son can be educated and I can still be part of his life. But I just do not think that Charbonneau is going to like this idea of farming. He's going to want to go back to the mountains. I know it. And having a child, less attention on him, Charbonneau, and more attention to the child, because the child is young and needs. And I just think that he is going to say that my son will stay with Clark and that he and I will go back to the mountains. I don't know this for sure, but it's just what I think.
Because he's a trapper by trade.
Yes.
So he's going to want to be out in the wilderness. He's not going to be locked into one place.
Well, that's what I think. Right now, as I said, he is meeting with Monsieur Clark about this farmland and animals, and I don't know how that's going to go.
It's as I think about this, and I imagine if this was my son, and you have got this rich tradition of living off the land, and you actually know how to grow food and how to find food, how to hunt for food, how to store food in the winter. And I wonder if your son, if he would miss some of that training, so some of those traditions would not get passed to him, because if Clark was raising him. But maybe that would be an advantage, because if the world is changing and it's going the direction that maybe Clark is going, where people have guns and civilization and all of that, I wonder if he's better off getting that education. Do you have thoughts on that?
I wish that my son could be raised like a Shoshone. I wish my son could meet my family. I wish my son could have all of those things. I don't really know about this education that Monsieur Clark is talking about. I don't understand what that is. Send him to this thing they call school. My family learned from our parents and our siblings. I don't understand this thing called school. Maybe he would learn languages. He would learn more languages, because I speak Shoshone and Hidatsa. Charbonneau speaks Hidatsa and French. We both know some sign language. So maybe he would learn more languages and that way probably meet more people. more white people, because that's the world that we are in right now.
Your son's name is...
Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau.
Okay.
But he named him after his father. His father's name was Jean-Baptiste. And so that's how he got his name. But I called him Pomp.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Where did the name Pomp come from?
It's just like a nickname. Sort of means first son, first born. And then Clark changed his name from Pomp to Pompey. He liked calling him Pompey and my dancing boy. And then everybody just started calling him that.
Where did dancing boy come from? Is it obvious or is there something specific that he did?
Well, you know how babies, when they lay on their back and they shake their hand, their feet and their arms?
Yeah.
So, and also there was this one man on the adventure who played this thing called a fiddle, which made this music. And anytime Pomp would hear that, he would shake his arms and his feet. When this person would play this fiddle, everybody would start dancing and Pomp would start moving his arms and feet like that as well.
Maybe Pomp is at heart a musician. Maybe he'll grow up to play music.
I don't know. Anything is possible, I suppose.
How big is the tribe, your Shoshone tribe, before you left the village? Well,
how
we're
big?
Taken from the village. Yeah, what's the size, the population?
Population? I don't know what that word means.
Yeah, I apologize. How many people lived with you? Was it just your family or were there lots of families?
Oh, there were lots of families. My family, we had one teepee. There were, I don't know how many teepees, but there were a lot of people. Remember, I said that we were nomads, and so we could pack up the whole village in an hour. Take down all the teepees, pack up all of our belongings, put them on the travoy on horses. So I don't think it was a lot of people, but it was a good size.
As nomads, was it primarily the buffalo that you followed?
No, not just buffalo. Deer, elk, antelope, moose, fox, beaver, rabbits, the pronghorn, squirrels. It was any sort of bad. The bison was the biggest. They were the biggest. But we wanted to make sure we stayed away from the bears that Monsieur Clark called grizzly bears. Stay away from the grizzly bears.
That's good advice. You've mentioned Clark, Mr. Clark, several times. You have not said Mr. Lewis's name a single time. And I'm curious, were you closer with Clark? Did you communicate with him more?
I would say yes. Monsieur Lewis was there, but Monsieur Clark... Well, first of all, Monsieur Clark was so interesting because his hair was red. I had never seen anyone with hair that color. He had this red hair. And also, Monsieur Clark had this, I guess he was an enslaved person like me, this man by the name of York. And he had skin that was black as night. I had never seen anyone with skin like that. I thought that his skin was painted on, but he let me touch his arm, and it was not paint. It was just the color of his skin. And the people in the village called him Black Indian or Big Medicine because he was a very big man. He was very strong. He could dance on his hands and show feats of strength. He was amazing and so powerful. Monsieur Clark said one time that, yes, York is amazing and powerful. And he said, imagine how powerful I, Clark, am if I control everything about York.
So that's what he said?
Yes. He said that he was powerful because he controlled everything about York. And I guess it touched something in my heart because Charbonneau controls everything about me. And like me, York worked very hard and he had no voice. Except there was one time that both York and I had a voice. One time. It was the only time, I think, in my whole life that anyone had asked my opinion. There was this time where Monsieur Clark asked everyone who was there where we wanted to put our winter camp, where to build this fort, which was going to be our home for the next 5 months while we waited through the winter. He asked everyone, and we all took a vote, including York, the black enslaved man, and me, a woman. They asked what I thought, and not only did they ask what I thought, but they asked me why I had that thought. And I had a good reason, too. I had a very good reason, because I chose the location where there was a lot of huapato, which is a root vegetable, kind of like a potato, where we could eat. In winter, it's hard to find food in the ground. The ground is frozen. But I knew on this one particular location, I could find those root vegetables. And so I said that was where we should camp, where there is food. And that was the only time I had ever been asked for my thoughts.
And they actually did listen to you, and you chose that camp.
Well, we took a vote, so everyone voted and everyone decided there. There were also, it seemed that there were more animals there that they could hunt because winter is very hard and cold and the ground is frozen and you can't find as many animals. And so I couldn't believe they were taking a vote and I was just standing there. I wasn't going to say anything and they turned to me and they asked me what I thought. Was one of the best times.
When you're talking about York, the enslaved black man, did you and he get along because you maybe felt that your stations were similar because neither of you really had a voice from day to day? Did you have a relationship with him at all?
No, I wouldn't say that. He spoke English. He did not speak Hadatsa or Shoshone, so I would see him, and I would, one of the things that I did was listen. I would listen to everyone, because that's the only way that I could get information. No one would come up to me and say, okay, we're doing this, or we're going here. So I would watch, and I would listen, and so I would see him. But it's not that we became friends or anything like that.
So what were the other men like on the Lewis and Clark expedition? You've got Clark, who's got the red hair, which was certainly novel for you, and you have the black man with the black skin. What were the other men like? I mean, some of them had blue hair, or some of them 7 feet tall. Were they rough-type people? Were they easy to deal with? What would you say to that?
Well, I didn't really have much to do with them. They were mostly frontiersmen and soldiers. And they worked very hard. There was so much to do. And they were very strong. Because when we got to the Great Falls, we couldn't get the horses. The horses were slipping. And these men were very strong. They could pick up big trees and boats and carry things up the mountains. And so they were very strong. And they spoke, most of them spoke English. There were a couple of Frenchmen who spoke French, but I think most of them were soldiers, because when we were going on this trip, Lewis and Clark wanted Charbonneau to come and they wanted me to come, so we moved into their fort. But Charbonneau did not like the terms of the work. He did not like having duties that their men had to do, like standing guard or doing soldier things. Charbonneau did not want to do that. So he tried to tell Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clark what he wanted to do, but Monsieur Lewis and Clark would have none of that. And they told Charbonneau, go away. So we left the fort. But Charbonneau thought about it once we were gone, and he really wanted to go on this trip. And so a few days later, we came back to the fort, and Charbonneau, he had to apologize to Monsieur Lewis and Clark, and he said he wanted to go, and he would do what he was told. And so they had us move back into the fort to get ready. And I was surprised that they wanted me to come, because I was having a baby in 3 months.
Well, yeah, and what about that? It's incredible that here, if you're 6 months pregnant and you've got 3 months left to go, I mean, these are not the easiest months for a woman to be pregnant. And maybe not the best time to be traveling across the world. That seems, you seem like an odd choice.
Well, I think you're wondering, did I have morning sickness, or did I wake up as the baby kicked inside me, or did I crave certain foods? But as usual, I kept quiet. I kept quiet. And they really wanted my Shoshone language skills. And we were staying there because we were waiting for the winter to clear before we started our journey on the Missouri River, because the river was frozen. And also there was a lot of preparation to do. So those 3 months that I was waiting to have the baby was time that they weren't going to be going anywhere right then. There was a lot to do. And there were 40 men preparing for this journey. And I was just another person who was helping to get ready for this. But when it came time to have the baby, my labor was tedious and the pain was so violent. Oh my goodness. And the strange thing was that these white men gave me the rattle of a rattlesnake mixed with water, and I drank it. And within 10 minutes, the baby was born. I had never heard of having the rattle of a rattlesnake mixed in water to help speed on the birth of my son.
And I'm guessing at that point you would have done anything to ease the pain.
Yes, it was very bad.
I will tell you, in this time, that is not something that we've continued to do. When a woman is having a baby, we don't kill a rattlesnake and say, drink this.
No. Nope.
So obviously it helped, but I don't know if it helps anymore.
I don't know if it really helped or if it's just I had been in pain so long and it was time. So I don't know if the rattlesnake really helped. But I think they were going to write that down in those books that they had. They were going to write that down to see if maybe when they got back, I can't remember. I think it was one of the Frenchmen who came up with that idea. I don't really remember because I was just in a lot of pain.
So the birth of Pomp happened while you were on the expedition.
No, we weren't. We were waiting to go. When Pomp was born, we were in Fort Mandan. They named it after the Mandans. And because they had come from St. Louis down the river, and they landed here, and they were going to continue to make preparations. And they had a journey already, and they had found some plants and animals that they were going to send back to their great father, Jefferson. And then we were going to continue the journey from Fort Mandan. But we weren't going yet when I had the baby. We were just in preparation stage. There was a lot of things that they were preparing. We had to make 300 pair of moccasins. We had to hew canoes because they needed some canoes from cottonwood logs. They had to make battle axes to trade for food. They were preparing, like I said, the plants and animals to send back to their great father, Jefferson. And they were also talking to people because they wanted to get as much information about what we would find once we started to go west. And they were making this thing that they called MAP. Have you ever heard of MAP?
Yes, I have heard of MAP.
I had never heard of that, but I guess maps show directions where we were to go so that we would not get lost. So they talked to anybody who they could talk to find what we would see. And they would put this down on these maps. And these maps were on something called paper. And they drew strange shapes that they could look at and understand. They called it writing. And they said they could read this writing. They could understand this writing. And it was their way to keep track of everything. Now, we Shoshone, we never had anything like that. To keep track of our stories and history, we would draw pictures that anyone could understand. But these maps on paper and these strange shapes, and they called it writing, was what they would do all the time. They would also draw some pictures of different things that they had never seen before. But there was a lot to do at Fort Mandan before we started the second leg of the journey, I guess you would call it.
Okay, so now let me get clear on this, because I think now I understand where I went wrong.
This was the middle of their journey. It was where Fort Mandan was where we lived. Charbonneau and I, we lived there. And so they came from St. Louis, and they got to the Mandan village. And that's when they decided they were going to winter there, and they built this fort and get information and make things. I already live there. So that was where the journey would begin for me. We were going to leave Fort Mandan and then continue the journey west. So it was the second leg of their journey.
It is amazing to me that somehow all of these men, these rough men, some of them soldiers, frontiersmen, these men thought what we need is we need a newborn child traveling with us. You had to be afraid. Were you?
I don't know. I don't think I was afraid because, well, we had this thing called a cradle board, which is, it's made out of wood. And I guess it's kind of what you would call a backpack that you put the baby in. And the baby is very happy because babies like to be confined. And also every time I move, he would move. And babies like that. They like when you're moving. And that's just what Shoshone women would do, and Hidatsa women too. All women, I guess. You always have your baby with you, and it doesn't stop you from living your life or doing your chores or going where you have to go, doing what you have to do. And I don't know. I don't think they really thought about, is it comfortable for me, or would I be happy taking the baby? And I don't think I thought that we were going quite as far as we went. They talked about going to see this big ocean, but I didn't think, how far is that? How long would it take? I just didn't think about that. I just did what I was told.
I guess this makes sense too, because as you're saying, your family, the Shoshones, they were nomadic.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been no big deal for you guys to say, okay, everybody throw your babies on your shoulder and grab the stuff and we're going to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody probably even said, how far are we going to go or how long is it going to take? That was just the way it was. They said, let's go. And so you went.
Yes, I think that's true. But this was further than I ever imagined. And this was further, our journey was further than going from my Shoshone village to when I was kidnapped to the Hidatsa village. This was further than that. I don't know how far it was because we don't think in those terms. They talked about how many miles, but that doesn't mean anything to me. It was just far.
You had said twice now, you've said Father Jefferson. I think I know who you're talking about, but I'm curious, who's Father Jefferson that Lewis and Clark were talking about?
That's their great, they called him the Great Father. He was the man who sent them on this journey. And from what, I'm not sure I totally understand because I didn't speak their language very well, but apparently this Father Jefferson bought this land from the French, from someone with a very strange name. I never heard a name like this. Napoleon? Have you ever heard of that man?
I have heard of him. In fact, I've spoken with him recently.
Oh.
Using the same device that I'm speaking to you with. And the purchase that they were talking about in our time, we call that the Louisiana Purchase.
Yes, which was, yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
just, I couldn't remember what it was called, but I knew there was some sort of purchase. But it strikes me very strange because all these white men come to this land and then they say they own it and they're buying it, giving trading things to own this land. And I just don't understand that because nobody owns the land. I didn't understand how that could be.
Well,
you live there, you share the land, but I just did not understand that.
It is so hard to imagine being 12 years old and you're out picking berries with your friend Jumping Fish, and then in a moment, your life changes forever. You're thrown on the back of a horse and taken from your family. How many people would buckle under the pressure and not survive? Yet, Sacagawea found a way despite all odds. In the next episode, you're going to hear how Lewis and Clark's expedition was an opportunity for Sacagawea to return to her home and what happened when she actually did go home. She'll also share some of the adventurous stories that happened along the journey where she nearly drowned and could have been eaten by a grizzly bear. I'm glad you're enjoying this podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe now, and we'll see you at the next episode of the Calling History Podcast with part 2 of Sacagawea.